gang. Hello, gang. Would you like to stroll down memory lane tonight, huh? Would you like to look at that rose cupboard? I have brought my axe along. I have brought my axe, and hey, you guys like to fall in here? I'm ready to go. If there are any other requests out there, we'd be glad to honor them. I didn't tell you, of course, there's a lot of things in my past that I have never yet quite revealed. It takes... Well, you have to protect the people who are still alive. You have to protect those years that are still festering. You have to be careful about those old clinkers that grew down in the bottom of the cellar of... time... And one of those secrets that I have kept so very, very long to protect the innocent, and also, in a sense, to protect the guilty, because after all, I suspect that the guilty need more protection than the innocent. Or had you ever thought of it that way? Hi, guilty. Are you ready to pay up? Protection, though? Well, one of the things that I have really protected throughout... Oh, by the way, those of you who want to know how it's going, from my favorite humor newspaper, you mind if I accompany myself tonight with the balalaika? Brought my axe along, and I'll be... Actually, this is not a classical balalaika. It's more of a... I'll tell you what, it's one of the secrets of my checkered past is that I am a... Well, in the past, I used to play one of these things. If you'd like to hear a little more, all it takes is just a little nudge, and I'm telling you, I'm going. Seriously, you want to hear a little more of that, Eddie? Do you like that? All right. From my favorite newspaper, which is, that is actually my favorite humor newspaper, although I don't know many newspapers that aren't humor newspapers these days. From my favorite humor newspaper, which is a... Thought it was the Village Voice, didn't you? Ah. Well, it's a Philadelphia newspaper, and it's the Bulletin, actually. And the Philadelphia Bulletin, there was an ad there that is advertising, all set out there for you. It's got this little girl sketched in a line drawing, a little naked girl. And above her, it says, Ivy League bikinis now available. Ivy League. Bikinis now available. Oh, we're filing that in the decline and fall department of our vast trivia file. There are other things to be reported in that department. And since it's very early on a Thursday night and the moon is lowering, oh boy, did you look at that moon out there? It's a half moon, and it's a little more than a half. It's about a three-quarter moon, and there is a special piece of Japanese music that relates to the half moon. And if I would be encouraged enough, just by one small hand clap, I will play for you a beautiful piece of music, which is an evocation, poetic evocation of the half moon. And to give you, actually it's the three-quarter moon. And it's the moon about to emerge from adolescence into full adulthood. It's really a parallel upon the life of a person, just a guy walking around scratching, and a little person emerging from the chrysalis stage. Now, if you would be interested in hearing this, I'll show you how it opens. Now, look. Here is the opening movement, which is the moon rising over Mount Fujiyama. The moon, however, in this case, is different than it has been up to now. The moon has been a mere infant. You see, the moon in much of Japanese poetry is looked upon as a person going through all the phases of non-existence, and that is called the dark of the moon. And then the moon is born, and there is a tiny sliver of moon. It sounds like this. See, that is the tiny moon crying as a baby would cry off in the next room. Barely heard, but making itself very, very well and understood and felt. Now, that is the first or the opening movement of the moon poem played for Koto. Now, in the second movement, the baby, now listen carefully, the baby has begun to enter young, lusty childhood. The baby is a very different thing now. Here, the opening move. Little playfulness. He has just broken his toy. And you know, yes, the touch, no, really, the touch of dissonance there of a young child unhappy with the breaking of a toy. However, the important thing to recognize here is the child does not yet know true unhappiness nor true happiness, which only comes with the years and with experience. And now the child is entering, and this is the moon that we have now. This is the moon of the half moon, or just verging onto the three-quarter moon, which is the adolescent moon. This is a moon of confusion. This is a moon that has sensed something in the air, but is not yet sure what it is. It is a moon of fear, and yet a moon of absolute confidence, albeit somewhat false. This is the adolescent moon. Enters stage with shout. As you notice, the moon is quite bright tonight. Adolescence. Is that this is the beginnings of poetry, and yet the poetry is somewhat callow. It is somewhat sentimental and over idealized. The idealization in this case, as is always the case with adolescents everywhere, the idealization of self. Into its full adulthood. The moon, however, in this case, becomes highly complex, becomes totally, totally involved not only with the world around itself, but becomes infinitely confused. The Orientals recognize this. We have a little trouble in that department. We feel that it's only because the right party is not in. We now play for you the full moon movement of the moon tone poem. Moon. Now, the moon of old age, the dying moon, but the moon with knowledge of not what it was all about, but the knowledge of an approaching end. Now the moon sings. The days of gold. And incidentally, there is a very close parallel in this movement with the early moon of childhood. The old man is as confused as the child. Now he has arrived at his 70 years plus. And now understands that he knows no more than he did at the age of 3. His voice is not as sweet as it was. But infinitely sadder. Speaks of his past. Moment of excitement. He calls to his wife. The sun. She answers. What is it? He says, I am dying. And so he does. It is now night. And the dark of the moon. But just as he dies, we hear the faint echo. Something is crying in the next room. Just faintly crying in the next room. What is it? Ah, a young voice. Calling for attention. A child has been born. We answer him. You got involved in this stuff, don't you? Now, you see, you asked for more, you got it, didn't you? Too much, wasn't it? He'd like more. Well, speaking of pablum eating children and the cast of the moon, this is WOR AM and FM New York. Okay? And while we're on the subject of the Oriental, we have with us tonight the Mandarin House. And I sing of you tonight the praises of the magnificent twice-cooked pork. Oh, boy. Oh, man. I am singing you tonight of the magnificence of the highly intricate and complex Chinese cuisine. And if you have never tasted twice-cooked, believe me, this... The Chinese phrase for it is highly intricate and complex and describes totally the dish. The rough translation, which is a very bad one, is twice-cooked pork. This is a Mandarin dish. One thing I would like to suggest you do. If you go uptown to Mandarin East on 2nd Avenue, just north of 57th Street, ask them for tiny, sweet spare ribs to begin your meal. They're tiny. They're about a quarter or maybe about a half inch long yet. Little tiny things. Unbelievable. And ask Dave there, who is the man in charge, or Mrs. Kuo, if she's there, ask them for the dish that I discussed on the air called twice-cooked pork. Believe me, if this doesn't glaze your eyeballs, you got gland problems. I would suggest you see about it. It is incredible. And it is one of the most beautiful little restaurants I've ever been in my life. And all the Oriental art in this restaurant. But, one thing. This is one Oriental restaurant that is not decorated with fluorescent lights and Chinese red linoleum seats. You know that kind of thing, like the kitchen floor look. This is a magnificent little restaurant. And all of the Chinese art that you see there, Chinese and Indian art, dates from the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries and is authentic. Beautiful place. And the prices you couldn't believe. It's on 2nd Avenue, just north of 57th Street, and it's Mandarin East. Great. Now, you see, there's a lot of... you want to hear... did we get any... No more koto playing. You don't want to hear any more of my... Oriental. I'll tell you, I've had a secret, had terrible, terrible thing. You get hooked on this like you get hooked on Mary Jane's. I got the promo. I'll do it a little later, Ted. I don't want to do it. You get hooked on playing certain instruments and making music the way people... You know, did you ever get hooked on peanut butter? Are you aware that in some states peanut butter is illegal? Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Oh, you can get addicted to peanut butter just like the poppy. Oh, it's terrible. Well, let me tell you, peanut butter, do you know that I went through a peanut butter phase one time where I, it's just an awful thing to have to admit, I was mainlining the stuff. I was eating peanut butter for every meal and steadily in between meals. And I would stop, I would lay off the peanut butter at about 11 o'clock at night. And I would wake up about quarter after 12, tossing restlessly in my sleep, reaching for the jug, that little short fat bottle that said chunky peanut butter on it, and I would start dipping. Well, I was going through, you know how some guys smoke 3-5 packs a day? I was going through about a case and a half of chunky peanut butter a week. It was just awful. It was terrible. I was laying it on pickles. Oh, I was laying it on everything. It's a awful thing to admit. It's an awful thing to admit. I was eating in those days, I put peanut butter in. Beer. You ever had peanut butter with a little beer mix? Oh, boy, wonderful. Seriously, have you ever had a peanut butter martini? Oh, just incredible, I'll tell you. And all the way up and down the line, I was peanut buttering. Well, do you know that some states have made it illegal because of that? That there was one lady one time they caught in Indianapolis who had been mainlining peanut butter for something like 30 years, and she weighed over 7,000 pounds. 7,000 pounds. And she filled an entire room. Just filled it up like a square. And they finally found her. I'll tell you how they caught her. One of her feet began to emerge out of a basement window. Just pushing it out. They finally caught her. They broke the house down and they... It was one of the reasons why... You want to hear more about... as long as we're on the subject of the moon, did you like our moon cantata? That is not available on recording. No. You heard it here, and you'll not hear it again until I get up the guts again to do it. There's another great one, too. There's a lot of funny Oriental music, which, you see, the Oriental music is not designed particularly to have a tune. It's designed to paint a sound picture. A very different kind of composition than we have. And all Oriental musicians are not really interpreters, but are creators. An Oriental musician is truly a jazz musician in the strictest sense of the word. He does not sit down and play somebody's tune. He will take a classical theme like the moon, or a classical theme such as spring, or the death of a flower, or any one of the great classical themes, and using classical techniques and within a classical frame, using a certain number it's quite a complex thing, because it's difficult to parallel it with our kind of composition. But within their term of the complex classical themes that they use, he will paint his own picture. He's not really playing somebody else's tune. Are you following me there? We keep thinking, you know, a musician is going to play Beethoven, what we think of, and really it's Beethoven who painted the picture, and everybody who comes after him who plays it is really just reproducing Beethoven more or less with fidelity. The great stress in Oriental music is not upon the composer, but the player. In Western music, it is upon the composer. We can get into that. It's a long thing. Ivy League bikinis have got me a little worried here tonight. But speaking of Ivy League bikinis, we have here coming to WOR TV, a TV promo here, Channel Whoopi, your Saturday night double feature. First at 7 p.m., the incomparable color and adventure of spectacular theater. Now, there's nothing like a spectacular production where they have 18 million slaves being whipped to death by the Pharaoh on a 7-inch screen in black and white. It's very spectacular, and that's what we're specializing in at 7 p.m. And at 9, the breathless excitement of supernatural theater. And there's hardly anything more scary, believe me, than the sight of a supernatural being appearing out of your 7-inch TV set with a bad sync circuit. Now, every Saturday night, beginning October 5th on WOR TV Channel 5. I started to tell the story the other night, and I'm afraid I forgot to finish it, and I'm going to have to finish it tonight just because it's been bugging me and I didn't tell the story. And it was the time the Taps really made the scene. It's pretty hard, you know, for us just living along here as we all do, just walking around, scratching, blowing our nose and looking at the sky and listening to Barry Goldwater and other comics and stuff and watching plays and things. It's pretty difficult for us to know where theatrics... By theatrics, I'm not talking about the theater per se, but I'm talking about the phenomenon of theatrics stop and some actual event occurs. Sometimes theatrics can become an actual event, I suppose. In fact, today it's an interesting kind of thing that's happening, at least interesting to me. This great hang-up suddenly that everybody is showing in vicarious involvement, vicarious experience of one kind or another. The idea of the movie now as a substitute for real experience has become a genuinely fast rising and moving phenomenon in our times. It really is, and I suspect that in the next 5 or 10 years, people will begin to write off their lives completely. A man's life is only worth as much as the number and the kind and the type of movies he has seen. That a man will measure his memories as he quietly expires in the last 5 minutes of his life. He will remember the great moments of his past. He will remember a great film that he saw, a great experience he had. He will remember a great play, a great moment where Geraldine Page said that fantastic thing to Rip Torn, And when he is dying and his life flashes before his mind, you know, it's like a guy, you know, he's going down for the third time when he's drowning. All the great movies he's seen will go past and through his mind. Because his life will have no memories at all. His life is a thing. He will become merely a vehicle for vicarious experience. He will become like a fountain pen. A fountain pen does not write stories, you know. A fountain pen does not write novels. It just doesn't. A hand takes a hold of it, and it begins to write, and one day that pen has written Moby Dick. Well, now, that I suspect will be, in the end, our fate. That I have noticed the growing thing in papers. There's one newspaper here today, which in New York, you guys out there, which does not report news any longer. It has what they call special color reporters who go to wherever news is happening, and they put it into a malleable form so that you can just understand how it really was being there, with the wind blowing and the trees going. They write a news item, Ed, as if it were a little one-act play. Because all the rest of the newspaper, actually, is really about 95% of it is either ads or columns about showbiz. There are endless columns about what's happening in TV and what's happening in the station. And these are real experiences to people. I'm sure that as a guy today, there are many kids, I'm sure, particularly, I'd say people roughly under the age of 20, who have had very little experience of their own. That everything they've experienced through a 16-millimeter lens. Or they've experienced it through the eyes of Elia Kazan. Or they've experienced it through Tennessee Williams. Or Patty Chayefsky. Or Edward Albee. And in the end, those will be the real experiences for people. They really will. They honestly will. I had a guy one time say this, look me right in the eye, and we were talking about war. And he says, don't you tell me. I know what war is about. The guy's about maybe 17. I said, well, that's very interesting. He said, yes. And I said, well, how do you know? He says, I've read Mailer. I know what war is about. James Jones. I've read James Jones. I never miss combat. And don't think I didn't see The Longest Day. Well, now, he believes that he has actually experienced this thing now. And when it's all over, this battle-scarred veteran, it's too bad that they can't give guys pensions for that. You know, I mean, you're a veteran for the one thing or another, and I'm sure that these battle-scarred veterans of the wars of the bedchamber, these battle-scarred veterans of the wars on the Normandy beaches, will, when they go, will count their blessings of memory as great moments in the cinema. Now, about 5 years ago, I did a thing which I happen to have on tape. About a slogan which appeared on Broadway. It appeared on 42nd Street and has since become a cliche, but at the time it was just a slogan that appeared over box office windows, you know, where they take the change. It said, get more out of life. See a movie tonight. Well, I thought that was pretty funny at the time, little realizing, of course, that that phrase would be echoed and re-echoed time and time again until finally people do believe not only can you get more out of life by seeing a movie, but the feeling really is today among the most hip people that the movie is life. It is life itself. And so you will see that the hipper the person is today, the more he's hung on movies. The slob doesn't go to the movies much, you know, and that's why Hollywood is having trouble. You will see lined up outside of any one of the art houses, you will see at least 5,000 penitents on any given night. If Peter Sellers is there or Ingmar Bergman is there living it for them, they're lined up. And in one hand they got their copy of The Village Voice, in the other hand they got their copy of Q, and wrapped up in their purse is a copy of The Realist. And everybody, they're living life, and they're living it very hard every night through the eyes of Antonini. Or Giacopetti and Mondo Canne, Giacopetti is looking at life real. And it's a wonderful thing. And to find that we've come full circle today, wherein a paper which started out to be an intellectual paper, there is an essay, and a very serious essay today, the paper is The Voice in this case, in case you're interested in source material. There is an essay in the current Village Voice, denouncing thought. It denounces thought as the last refuge of the scoundrel. It denounces logic as the last big cop-out. What you should have is passion, and passion itself has replaced logic. And passion has its own logic, and it's a very, very... That's all part of that same phenomenon of living totally, almost completely vicariously. Now, just like the fairy tales of old, the old mini singer sitting around in the baronial hall, where the sound of dogs yapping and the sound of the Duke belting down 7 pounds of horse meat as he gets ready to knock down a half a gallon of mead. The mini singer and the storyteller before him did pretty much the same thing. He described a life that never was. He told long, fanciful tales. But the difference, of course, between the minnesinger and the Duke and the Lord at that time is that the Lord never pretended at any moment, as far as we know, that the minnesinger was producing real life for him. He just sat there, and once in a while he'd throw a bone at him or kick him in a soft spot, and that was about the end of it. But he never once said, "The minnesinger is telling me what life is really about." Because there it was. It was all around him. He didn't have to be told what it was about. But today, of course, that we've come a long way since that. And we know now, today, that life is not what you're living in the Grand Concourse. You know that. We know that life is not what you're living out there in the Bronx and out there in Staten Island and Darien. It's the life that is being lived between those 35-millimeter frames that's the real thing. I wonder how many people are going to go to Rome this year and are going to be thoroughly disappointed to find that La Dolce Vita existed only on film. Yeah. And of course, they'll find out now, and it'll finally come to them, that what they should do is live in the film. They should spend their time watching Rome through films. Don't go to Rome. That's a real drag. Watch it in film. There is another essay in the same issue of The Voice about this girl writing, and she's very teed off about Paris. Well, I'll tell you why she's teed off about Paris. For over 25 years, most Americans have been influenced by movies about Paris, not real Paris. And even when a guy did go to the real Paris, he would fight like mad to try to find the movie version of Paris, if at all. And then when he didn't find it, he felt that it was a failure on his part. He would say, well, and of course he'd grown up with Gene Kelly running through the rain with Audrey Hepburn or Fred Astaire in the rain and singing in the rain and night in Paris, you know, that whole jazz. Well, he never found it when he went there. So he figured that was because he had gland trouble, or his eyes weren't good, or he didn't go to the right neighborhood in Paris. Well, now it's slowly beginning to develop as people sit over there that Paris is like everybody else. There's drunks and there's cigar butts in the curbs, you know, and people hit people and guys drive like nuts, and you know, it's and your knee still hurts you when you get over there. In fact, may even hurt you worse. And so they're beginning to denounce Paris, but what they're really denouncing is their own sad illusions, which they have carried for years about this. And in reverse, what's so odd, many a European comes to America and is astounded to find that America is not nearly as rotten as it is in the films. You know, he comes over here loaded with a .45 stuck in his underwear. He comes over here with 9 money belts, you know, all hidden, concealed in his jockey shorts. And he comes over here with, blackjacks in his attaché case. And he walks around, you know, and there are people just walking around scratching. And he's been brought up on movies, you know, the rough, hard, tough, the Naked City type thing. He sees Naked City there, and he keeps looking up at the roof, waiting for guys to run along the roof and shoot it out up there by the pigeon coats, you know. And he never finds it. So then he winds up saying, well, I didn't go to the right neighborhood. That's what happened. And I know that they're out there. And of course, you know, I never find that New York or that life that people are continually trying to say is the real life of New York that they put into their movies. Again, using all the same old symbolic jazz, the same old stuff that guys from Cedar Rapids always put into their movies when they come to New York and they're trying to say this is what New York really is. It's like poor Irwin Shaw just discovering Paris and girls in love there. There was a beautiful episode in The New Yorker about that. But more and more, I'm wondering how far we're going to go with this carrying of illusion. Now, the reason I'm bringing all this up is a great news item, just a wild news. Listen to this now. There are two news items that make me wonder just where reality stops and where it begins. Of course, anybody who's ever been in any kind of real historical action knows that the historical action that he has observed rarely comes through the way it really was when he reads about it later. It just isn't. It's like a friend of mine is now living in Chicago, Ed, and he's from New York. He's been there 3 years, and he says he is honest enough to say this. He says, already I have totally fictionalized my life in New York. He says, I believe really now that Sixth Avenue is lined with great waving elm trees, and that Seventh Avenue is peopled with healthy, smiling faces of friendly, jovial, singing citizens. And every night in the BMT, they sing old Richard Rogers favorites on their way out to Brighton Beach. Of course, he says, it's much better to have it that way. He says, I'm scared to come back. It's much better to be this way. And so he says, I've finally come full circle now, and when people come out and visit me in Chicago, or when Chicagoans tell me how rotten New York is, I get on my lute and I start singing. I start singing about my life on elm tree-lined 6th Avenue in the 50s. Forgotten completely about the cigar butts and the beer cans. And the guy laying in the gutter there, you know, that big fat drunk. Composition called Persistence of Memory, played on single string. But it is an interesting problem, and one I don't think we'll ever lick totally. And of course, there have been a lot of writers who have talked about this thing for a long, long time. Writers have discussed this problem. Oh, have you noticed that speaking of persistence of memory and our refusal to look around life, you know, there's been a lot of things done recently on discrimination, one kind or another, in the movies, discrimination in television shows. Have you noticed that all the people who are portrayed doing discrimination belong to no discernible, I suppose you might say, racial or national background? Have you noticed that? It's very interesting, and yet all of us know that whenever you portray people of no discernible racial background, you're portraying certain people. And so the only assumption that we can make by watching these shows is that only certain people discriminate. That's an interesting attitude. You know that I overheard a guy talk the other day in the television industry, and he was talking about that problem. You know, this. You notice recently we had a big thing about painting stripes on the streets and so on. It's fascinating that the guy who says we should stop painting stripes on the streets is called a guy with a small-town attitude, when in actuality he has a cosmopolitan attitude. And the guy who would paint the stripes for everything that goes on in town has this true small town attitude. That's what they would do in Appleton, Wisconsin, actually. But so, as you know, this is just in passing, and I'm not against anybody having stripes. So immediately a lot of guys are going to write angry letters, which is pretty silly. However, getting back to this discrimination problem is a very, very difficult thing. And And as you know, on any given a crime show, for example, you cannot show the criminal as being any discernible nationality. So, of course, he always winds up a Methodist or you know, just an ordinary guy named Charlie Johnson or something like that. Of course, don't kid yourself, Dad. It's not that simple, this problem. And, of course, it's easy to reduce it to a simplicity situation like that. I'm afraid, though, in the end, we're gonna hate all guys who look like those guys that are always being shown on television as being the discriminators, thereby ignoring about 90% of the population by default. Just by saying, well, they don't do it. Well, I don't know about that. This gets to be a really complex thing. And one of the guys in television said this to me. He says, you know, it's getting so that any given television show you do, if you show anything that's even remotely concerned with real life, you're going to get a complaint. You're going to get wild, insane complaints from everybody about that. So he says, what they think is the eventuality of television will be that there will be no people at all on TV. There will be no people on television at all, and everything will be cartoons. And they won't even be people cartoons. They will be ants and grasshoppers. There will be turtles, and they will act out these love stories, and they will act out these stories of discrimination, one thing or another. And I'm sure, though, I'm sure that after the fourth or fifth show like that, somebody will write in and say, come on, wise guy, that was an Italian moose. I could tell that all the way. And so you wind up in probably in the end they will have no symbols at all, just little dots and squares will move around on the screen, and perhaps that will be the end result. And these dots will have no discernible color. They will all be cream of wheat color or matzah color or something color, you know, just color. It just goes float around there, indeterminate color, so that none of us can get mad. And thereby, by the way, since none of us can get mad, none of us will ever really recognize anything that's going on as being pertinent to anything that's going on. You want to hear Persistence of Memory? Or would you like to hear another one of my wonderful compositions called The Dream? No, we better not play this. It's a little late, and the kids are up, and a lot of things going on. And I have a great composition called Get More Out of Life. Listen to the radio. It's a great one. It has all kinds of feedback going on in it, and speaker cone rattling, stuff like that, and bad connections, static, all symbolic, you know, very symbolic. The times when you have to say it, and then there are times when you just have to sit. And then there are times. Keep your knees loose, Fred. And, did you know that? They're bringing out Taps as a rock and roll tune? Yeah, it's one of the kids are doing it. It's great. They've got this electric guitar. This guy that's playing this tenor horn through his nose. It's fantastic. It's all done into an echo chamber, and you'll like it. It's called Lights Out Rock. It's great.